Welcome to Success Is Podcast. I'm your host, Phil Portman, serial entrepreneur, author, and podcast host. Whether success for you is more money, time with your family, a healthy, well-balanced life, or freedom, I'm interviewing guests and getting you the advice to make it happen. So join me as we uncomplicate the complicated, help you define success, and give you the strategies to make it happen. Hello, and welcome to the Success Is Podcast. I'm your host, Phil Portman. And joining us today is Jerry Gadori, a number one best-selling author, dynamic speaker, and the founder and CEO of Redbeard Solutions, a company that's redefining what it means to lead with impact in today's business world. Jerry brings decades of leadership experience, and his mission is clear: to empower professionals and organizations to rise above the noise and lead with purpose. Whether he's speaking on stage, writing best-selling books, or coaching entrepreneurs, Jerry's passion for helping others succeed is unmatched. Jerry, it is an absolute pleasure to have you on here. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. It's an honor, Phil.
So let's kick it off with, what does success mean to you?
I'll tell you, I don't think I have a very complicated definition. For me, success is all about having options in whatever it is that I'm doing. The more choices I have, the richer I feel.
Couldn't agree with you more. So let's walk through your journey. Can you walk us through, how did you get into leadership and then eventually become the CEO of Redbeard Solutions? Tell us a little bit about your background.
Bad life choices. So, former United States Marine, I did signals intelligence in the Marine Corps. I'll take it one step earlier. So I was an indifferent high school student. I enjoyed fighting. I enjoyed female company and I enjoyed beer. I majored in graduating, and that was really all that I cared about. Shortly after high school, I noticed my friends were really moving in two different directions. Some of them were going on to college and making the type of decisions that lead to a good life. Others were starting to get into the type of trouble that sticks, and I wasn't heading to college. So for me, joining the Marines was a no-brainer. When I joined, I actually did really well on my ASVAB, top couple percent in the country. And it was one of my dad's first inklings that I was actually intelligent. And I say this to say, he thought in high school, and the reason he didn't give me a tough time, he just didn't think I was very bright. So when he realized I was, in fact, intelligent, he got pretty angry at me. And me joining the Marines became a little bit of an escape. So I did signals intelligence, as I mentioned, the Marines. So I had TSSCI clearance, got into software development, cybersecurity. After my time in the Marines, I made it to sergeant, damaged my knee, 4 knee surgeries later. And the Marine Corps didn't need sergeants who can't run, so I became a civilian again. Started my civilian career as a technical recruiter at a technology staffing firm. And I'll tell you a quick funny story there. To date myself, this is before job boards and everything. I replied to a classified ad. And when I went out for the job, I didn't even know what a staffing firm was. I assumed I was going to interview with a company. And I got there and the recruiter I was supposed to meet with had some type of personal problem, couldn't make it. The manager felt badly that I'd driven all that way and interviewed me. 15 minutes into the interview, she said, "Mr. Gadori, you clearly don't have the qualifications for this job, but have you ever considered technical recruiting?" And that's how I got into this business. That was my first go at being in this industry at all. And the funniest part is, I said yes because I had a family to feed. I had no interest in becoming a technical recruiter. I told myself, I'll be close to the tech jobs. I'll just take the first job that makes sense. Fast forward to now, I'm talking to you about a career spent in the space.
Yeah, crazy. Do you think school is a line for people like us?
No. Not at all. School is designed to teach people how to be a citizen in a post-industrial country. And it's not in any way in alignment with what people need today.
Yeah. So, you know, I think about that, the Robert Kiyosaki book, right? Why do A students work for C students and B students work for the government? I always go back to that I struggled in school. I think I graduated with like a 2.5. I was not great with school. And one of the things that I had difficulty with was
well, I'd argue with my teachers a lot, but things showing my work on certain things when I could just get to something quicker just didn't make sense to me. I didn't like the process and being told, no, you have to do it this way, you know? And then I got out of school and realized that in the business world, the way they were teaching me things didn't make sense at all. Like, you know, yes, subordinates, you want people that follow directions, listen, and do things exactly as they're told. But in the business world, you got to figure out the quickest, fastest, cheapest way of doing it better than your competition, or you're going to get bulldozed over.
At risk of train wrecking the show, I will jump on this tangent and say that the way our education system is structured is worthless. And that includes college. The majority of folks that go through a degree don't need one. And the jobs where you really do need to go to college, medicine, law, things like that, the way we've structured it makes no sense. It's just another business. We look at the cost of education today versus the output that folks get. A lot of the degrees that people graduate were vanity degrees for the wealthy 25, 30, 40 years ago. And now people are graduating and then they're surprised that their $45,000 a year job doesn't pay their $60,000 a year college bill.
Yeah. And on the flip side, the services world, the trades fields are paying higher than ever because there's such a lack of your electricians, your plumbers, your HVAC, right? And all these fields are doing, you know, phenomenally. So let's switch topics a little bit. I want to talk about specifically about your leadership roles. You've had a variety of leadership roles over the years. Can you talk about how it's evolved or how your leadership has evolved? And was this something that your evolution, did it come from your time in the military, your time working with these businesses, reading? What's really influenced your leadership style?
You really hit the three main areas. I'm a voracious reader. I read probably 2 or 3 books a month. From my Marine Corps time, I learned the core of leadership. I would say that's the center of my leadership being is what I learned in the Marines. Not even the formal things, you know, the JJ did tie buckles and BAMSIS and all the things that we learned in boot camp and expanded on as we developed into non-commissioned officers, but just the way that Marines interact with each other and their leadership. Reading definitely shaped it, but the biggest overall body of my evolution has been through my consulting. I spent the better part of a decade working with technology services companies, so technology staffing, custom software development, software implementation, networking, cybersecurity companies, ranging from, gosh, $500,000 a year in revenue all the way up through publicly traded, but the majority of them being probably in that $5 to $25 million range. In that time, I really got to see what works, what doesn't work, and what common practices are. I discovered that 85% of all of these businesses run virtually identically, but that 15% delta, wow, that's where things happen. And it also highlighted one of the most important things about leadership as it relates to service companies. And that's that in a service company, there is no secret sauce. The only thing you have in a service company is the willingness of a team to excel. There's no magic in it. And that's a leadership thing, 150%. Those things combined to really shape my perspectives on leadership.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you. I talked about this before in the past, like, you know, my company, if someone came through and stole our secrets, our technology and all that stuff, would they have our company, right? If they stole our name, would they have our company? And it's like, no, it's the leaders. It's the people within it. It's the culture that creates it. And that you can't steal. There's a reason why these companies, you could put them in any area and they can excel in. And I couldn't agree with you more on that.
Yeah, it really, every problem, again, I've been doing the civilian side of this since the late 90s, early 2000s. Every problem I've ever seen in every company I've ever encountered is a leadership problem. It manifests differently. It appears differently. It gives different symptoms, But when you boil everything away, it's a leadership problem. The good news is, if you're a leader in a company, that makes it your problem and your ability to resolve.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, if you have something uniform across the board, it's coming from the top, right? Yep. Absolutely.
No company ever grows past its leaders.
So here's an interesting question I have for you. Have you ever had to unlearn something you were taught early in your career or in the military?
Yeah, so going back to leadership again, so the way that I led in the Marines, though aspects of it were foundational, I still use today, the actual hands-on way is wildly ineffective in a civilian workplace. I work now with a lot of government contracting companies, and they're populated primarily at the leadership level and the ownership level with retired officers, typically around the lieutenant colonel level and senior enlisted. And you would think that companies like that would have no leadership problems, but nothing is further from the truth, because military leadership and civilian leadership are fundamentally different in a couple areas. The number one being the mobility and options of the workforce. If you're in the military, you go where you're assigned. It's not a choice. If you're a leader, you don't interview for your team. You take the team you're given and you make them into what you're going to make them into. When you're a civilian, that's not the case. I was so bad at leading in my first job. And quick story on that in a minute, I can expand if you'd like. But I was so bad in that job that my manager would send people she wanted to leave the company to my team.
No way.
It's embarrassing, but it's true. I treated them like, you know, young junior enlisted in the Marines, which, spoiler alert, civilian folks don't much enjoy.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And I didn't do it out of maliciousness. It was ignorance. I didn't understand what I didn't know. And I feel the need to tell the rest of the story. My training in that company was this. And this, by the way, is a very big part of leadership in business. My manager said, hey, you are crushing it in sales. You're personally outbuilding the bottom seven offices in the company combined. How would you feel about leading a team? It's like, that sounds great. I want to learn that piece. She goes, great. She handed me a box of business cards that said sales manager on it, introduced me to the new team. That was my training. That was it. I just tried to teach them what I did, and I used my Marine Corps sergeant background to lead them. Once again, civilians didn't appreciate that.
No. So how'd you make the shift? What changed from there?
Well, abject failure was a nice beginning point. It wasn't working. So that was a quick indicator. But I start to read like crazy. Yeah. A huge fan of Stephen Covey, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. I took every training that I could. I really asked myself, because I'm going to say this again, I wasn't intentionally a bad leader. I wasn't intentionally a bad manager. I don't like to bully people. I don't like to make people feel badly. But the things that a Marine experienced would let them know that what I was saying wasn't meant to be aggressive. Just the Marine Corps, unsurprisingly, has a pretty aggressive culture. So I had to learn, you know, how to translate that in a way that made sense to people who didn't have that shared life experience, you know, and also learn that, you know, personal space and physical contact, those are real things in the civilian world. So I did a ton of reading and any training opportunity I could get, whether it was on my time or not, I took.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's kind of expanding on that. How has your leadership style adapted or changed dealing with internationally? I know we were talking about, you know, your dealings with India and other countries. Do you approach that differently? And if so, how did you adapt your style to those countries?
So a couple of things, starting with the core leadership piece, it's getting to know and understand the wants and desires of the people that report to you. So a quick related note, I'm not a fan of groups of over seven. If you've got a team, it's difficult to manage more than seven people in a one-on-one relationship and give them the support they need in tough times. So sometimes you have to do more, yes, but I'm a fan of five to seven. So when you get to know and understand what their desired outcome is, what they're trying to achieve, and what they're looking for, it's much easier to shape your requests in a way that makes sense for them and to create linked goals out of the things you need them to achieve and the things that they want to achieve. That's the first thing. The second thing, as it relates particularly to international folks, is taking the time to understand a little bit more about their culture. Now, we talked about India. India is particularly difficult because there isn't really a unified culture in India. You've got something like 17 spoken languages in India. There are, from a faith perspective, you have significant camps of Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, and obviously Hindu folks. And so it's just a wildly different place. You've got parts of India that are extremely advanced and parts that literally don't have electricity yet. So there's not a unified culture. Having said that, the types of folks that you attract to your business will have more of a unified culture. So understanding that helps you to package your message. But if your message is, my job is to help you advance, it'll get through.
Yeah. Yeah. They want to see that you're there for them and you're working on a common goal together, a purpose.
Yeah. It sounds infantile, but it's so true. The more that people understand that you want to see them succeed, the more that they want you to succeed. Why? Because you're incentivizing them to do the things that you need. It's just human nature. It creates, again, those linked goals.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yep. The number one motivator is purpose in the workplace, not money, actually. So
exactly. Yeah. And you know, quick related note here, do you know why money gets brought up all the time though? Why people think it's money?
Why is that?
Easy to talk about. If I work for you and I go get another job because I don't like you, I don't like the way you treat me, I don't like something, it's much less confrontational for me to say, hey Phil, I got a $10,000 raise. You know, it's money's always part of it, but you're right, it's never one. But the reason it seems number one, just easy to talk about. That's so much easier than, hey, Phil, you know what? I feel like you micromanage me. I feel stifled and my career is stagnating.
Yeah.
Oof, yeah. Which conversation would you rather have?
Right. You know? Yeah. Yeah. Because the money side, you can almost rationalize. But the other thing, you're taking personally and saying, well, what do you mean? You know?
Exactly. And if you're at an exit perspective, not in a counseling perspective, I don't want to have that hard conversation with you. There's no win it for me, just a miserable hour, you know? Yeah. So again, if we're at an ending, why would I do anything but what's easier?
Yeah, absolutely. Promotions from within, do you have any specific things that you look for in an individual that you're going to be promoting? And then on the flip side, what do you do to prevent what you had where they just hand you a stack of business cards and say, congratulations, you're a leader now?
Yeah. So first of all, it's my company and that's an Insta-fire if anybody ever did that. but I will say it starts way before that. And this is one of the most important things I talk about in my book. So the people side of your business is a continuum that starts at the first time that they engage with your job advertisements or ever hear about your company, straight through the exit interview and what their post-employment experience is like in still interacting with your brand. So when I'm coming to understand what people want and like, I'm asking them in the interview, what are you trying to achieve in your career? What do your next steps look like? What are your strengths? What are your weaknesses? What are you hoping to learn next? I'm learning all of those things to ensure that we're a cultural match, that I can work with this person, all that stuff. Once they start with one step back. One other thing that I also ask or say to them, I should say, is I say, look, my commitment to you as the owner of the company is that I'll do everything I can to help you grow in whatever their role is, recruiter, salesperson, graphic designer, doesn't matter, whatever it is. If you do the things I ask, I will see that you grow. So I'm setting the expectation from before they even see an offer as to how I'm going to interact with them. I reiterate that during the offer stage. I reiterate that again in orientation, and it comes up through our one-on-ones. And I show them through team meetings that I listen to ideas and I take in information Do I act on all of them? No. Some of the ideas are better than other ones, and we best idea wins. But I always listen to them, and they see that people internally get the first shot at promotions. And I explain to people whenever a new role opens up that would represent a promotable opportunity, I will look inside first. I will not limit my looking to inside, though. So again, you guys get first shot, but if somebody wildly better is outside the doors, organizationally, we want to grow. And we do that by having the best people there. And I'll tell you a quick extreme example from earlier in my career. Many, many moons ago, when the earth was young and the world was flat, I worked in the rent-to-own industry for a brief period of time. In very related news, it's the only job I ever had that made me feel bad about myself. It's the reason I didn't stay in it for very long. It's a very ghoulish industry. But quick note, so a company that I worked for, the owner's perspective was that he would not hire anybody above the level of store manager. Every single person came in as a store manager, was promoted up. Now, when things were going well, that was a great model because there was unity. There was a similarity of thought. There was a strong culture. We all came from the same place. When things went bad, you had 55 different people saying the same thing with a different voice. There were no new ideas, no new concepts. It was a built-in bottleneck.
Yeah.
So I believe strongly on promoting from within, but never limit yourself to only doing that for that reason. So circling back to your simple answer, I'm making overly complicated. I set the expectation from the beginning. I manage it throughout the process. I over-communicate. Leaders, if you feel like you're dramatically over-communicating, you're probably almost communicating enough.
Yeah, absolutely. So you seem like a guy who's got, you know, clear focus on your goals, driven, you're ex-military. How do you balance that with creating an environment where you're getting feedback, that you're not getting a bunch of yes men around you?
Yeah. So this is the hardest thing for most folks. You got to kill your ego dead. You, as the owner of the business, will have many of the good ideas. You didn't get where you are by accident. But if you give an image where you're disdainful of information you get, if somebody gives you a dumb idea and you embarrass them because of their idea, you're never getting an idea from them again. If you react harshly to feedback, whether it's accurate feedback or not, you're never getting that feedback from that person again. So you have to learn how to take it. Even when they say, hey, Jerry, I really don't like the way that you work with me. I find your tone disrespectful. Whatever it is, you just have to smile and say, thank you for that feedback. I'll do everything in my power to fix it. I'm not perfect. I'll probably make mistakes again, but sharing that information is helpful.
Sure.
Even if you want to take them out back and strangle them like the old Simpsons episodes, you can't do that. And the way you do that is by, you know, killing your ego dead. You're not there for self-aggrandizement. You're there to grow your company. And the way you grow your company is by growing your team.
Yeah.
Having said all that, you've got to grow yourself too, but that's not the place for that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Some of the biggest growth that you'll make as a leader is being able to swallow that ego, right? Because it's taking that feedback. It's giving others credit. It's all of those things that you do along your journey. That
it's a good idea to them. If it's a bad idea, it's you.
Right. Yep. Couldn't agree with you more on that. So we haven't really talked about your companies or what you got working on. Can you tell us a little bit about your company and everything you have going on in the world? You've got a lot going on. So can you kind of tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, I probably have a little too much going on. So I'm currently running two companies. I'm the CEO for a company called Qualys One, which is a high volume technology services company. I'm doing that as a favorite of some friends. I'm the founder and CEO of Redbeard Solutions, which is my own company. Redbeard Solutions is focused predominantly on the younger / smaller technology service companies. So typically from $1 million to about 30 million in that zone. We help them to become what I call a destination employer. That's the title of my book, Destination Employer. So what it does is it teaches technology services companies how to develop the reputation in the marketplace as the location for top talent to 10x their careers. So if you think as a business owner, what would it mean to your business if when your name comes up, people think, wow, I could 10x my career there? What would that mean to your ability to recruit, to retain, to attract top talent? And as that reputation gets out there, what would that mean to your business development? If people know that top talent goes to you, how likely are you to beat your competitors out on work? So we really help them with the entire people side of their business. We teach them how to build employer brands. We teach them how to recruit and hire in a world-class way. We will do it for them if they need help. We will support their recruiting team if they need help. And most importantly, though, aggravatingly, if that's a word, the place where I get the least amount of attention is we work with them on their retention, how to be the type of company that people don't want to leave. And it's super frustrating because nobody wants to talk about that part, but it's the most important part. It's easier to fill buckets than it is colanders. And yet people are like, I can't get the best. All my good guys are leaving. I need to replace them. I'm like, no, you need to stop making them want to leave, and then we'll look at replacing them.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's back to that ego thing, probably typically, right? Because if you have a consistent behavior like they're leaving, that probably is a leadership problem, correct?
There's no problem. I will say again, every business problem is a leadership problem. And that's the great example of one. To be fair, though, you know, we're being kind of tongue in cheek. I don't want business owners to think that, you know, we think they're, you know, Bluto from the old Popeye cartoons. You know, what typically happens is most folks who start small businesses, they don't start small businesses because they want to start small businesses. They're doing something that they're passionate about. So technology services, they're an incredible salesperson, they're an incredible recruiter, incredible technologist. They want to make something cool. They want to do something they like without the hassle of working for a company. So they get together a group of 5 or 10 of their friends or colleagues. They start a company. It starts to get successful. Once they grow, depending on the business vertical, to $5 or $10 million, typically in technology services, it's around $10 million. The club that you all go to and make money at has to become a real business. Mm-hmm. And that transition is harder than you would think. And on top of it being harder than you would think, not that many people are around to help those folks. And on top of that, a couple of key factors have changed. Most likely, if you've grown your company to $10 million, you're probably one of the more successful folks in your social circle. Yep. You're probably not working 7 days a week anymore. You're probably living a pretty great lifestyle. So when people, you know, they climb, they hit that 10 million and they plateau and they're trying to figure out how to fix it. When somebody like me comes in and shows them, and they then understand that they're probably going to have to take some of that money and move it back into the center of the table, they're probably going to have to start putting in more hours for a period of time. Then that desire rapidly becomes them saying that they want to and not falling through because they realize there's a lot more work to break through and make that next climb.
Sure. It's like, you fixed my problem, but not with me. Yeah. And
that's my first company, Influence Understood, that was, so the very first project I would do with a company was an assessment that we called the revenue roadmap, where I would go in, I would look at their operations and see what the problem was. I charged $6,500 for it. I generated a 5-page report and a project plan on, if you were to hire me to help, this is what I do. And that amount varied. It depended on lots of stuff. It could be as little as, you know, a couple months of training and stuff for 10, 20 grand. It could be more than $100,000 engagement. It varied pretty wildly. But I would give them the findings on that report. And sometimes, you know, they would hire me. Sometimes they wouldn't. Frankly, if I didn't think that I would like working with them, I made the project plan ridiculous so that they wouldn't hire me. That was a little bit of me editing myself out of that loop before the pain started. But anyway, they would look at that report and they would make their decisions. But sometimes, like, an average project was probably around 40-50K. So they would work through that project. It would become clear to me that they weren't actually executing. And we get to the end, and I will have billed them, you know, periodically for a total of $50,000-$60,000. And I'd expect a kick in the pants on the way out the door because we didn't accomplish much. And I'd get a pat on the back and a thank you, and this was wonderful and such an incredible experience. And I was thinking to myself, you've changed nothing. It took me a couple iterations of that to realize that they realized the amount of work they would have to do, and they didn't want to own that. So then, rather than either do the work or confront me, it was easier to pat me on the back and send me on my way and essentially pay $50,000 for a therapy session to realize that they were the problem and they needed to fix it.
Wow. That's incredible. Yeah.
I'll tell you. So I started off that company doing sales training and recruiter training, and then it evolved into manager training, and then it evolved to executive coaching, and then it evolved to taking senior executive roles, you know, 18-month contracts in different companies to get them past the hurdle. And I will say the executive coaching especially, it really manifested as sports psychology. You know, getting these guys and gals out of their own head, reminding them that if you built a $10 million business, you weren't lucky. You didn't do that over 7 years and have a seven-year string of luck. But it was also realizing just how much of an impact human psychology has on business success. Again, I'll say it, no company outgrows its leader. Where the leader stops is where the company stops.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. Well, great. Well, Jerry, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show today. For people listening in and following us, where do they get in touch with you? Where do they follow what you have going on?
Gosh, I'm on LinkedIn. I'm an embarrassing amount of time. I have my own show. I have this dude named Phil Portman who's going to be on one of the episodes here.
Yeah.
And I've got a YouTube channel. So if you're looking for me publicly, those are easy places. I'd love if you checked out my book on Amazon. I'd love it more if you left me an honest 5-star review. Other than that, I sometimes speak at conferences, so you can see me there as well.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And thank you for listening to this episode of Success Is. And if you haven't already, make sure you like and subscribe to the Success Is podcast, where we continue to explore the real stories behind what success means from leaders who are living it every day. Thank you. Until next time.